And jumping off this discussion of taxes and politics, we turn to our regular political commentators, E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and the Brookings Institution, and David Brooks of The New York Times. Good to see you both.
Good to be with you.
So we currently have dueling tax plans out there, right, with Governor Romney stepping in today, but also President Obama, and both Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich on the road have talked about this. What's significant to you, and I'll start with you, David, about where this conversation is going, especially on the Republican side?
Well, it's almost on both sides. You know, there's been a consensus, I think, about a general approach. We've got to lower rates but close loopholes. And that was in Simpson-Bowles. Notionally, Barack Obama has been for that. The Republicans are all for various iterations of it. The question is, can you do it politically? Every president comes in office and say, yeah, I want to simplify the tax code. Then their aides say to them, you know, you'd have to violate this special interest, that special interest. And then they all say, eh, maybe I won't do that.
Yeah, the devil's in the details, right? I mean, well, which loopholes do you close?
Right. And in the special interests, who want to protect those loopholes? Some of them not so special. So Romney is to be commended for a pretty big reform, which has individual rates and corporate rates. The president had a much more modest, just dealing with the corporate rates, but they're both marching sort of in the same direction. I think eventually we'll get there, which is what the country needs.
I'm surprised to see how similar these things are in a way. EJ?
I think they're quite different, and I hate to break David's consensus, but not everybody agrees by any means that we need to lower rates, especially given how much we've cut taxes on the rich in the last 10 years. It strikes me that Romney's plan is announce you're cutting taxes on everybody, say you're going to close loopholes, don't specify exactly what loopholes you're closing or don't give much detail. That's not a tax plan. That's a 30-second ad. Obama's plan is not as broad as Romney's. He's not talking about the income tax system. He's talking about the corporate tax system. And it is a plan, and it makes choices. He gets rid of most loopholes. He lowers the rates but keeps as much revenue coming in. And he has one big preference for creating manufacturing jobs in the United States. Now, I happen to agree with that bias. You can argue about the details, but whether you agree or not, it's something you can actually argue about. Funnily enough, the Obama plan has at least something in common with Rick Santorum, who has proposed scrapping taxes altogether on manufacturing, which I don't think would work. But I do think the manufacturing bias is a good idea.
Yeah, I'm not sure too many economists agree with that. It's a good political idea, but not too many economists think you can make that distinction sensibly. It's small. It's a good idea. It's a sensible idea, the idea of lowering the rates and close loopholes. But the Obama plan is pretty small. And now EJ is obviously right that the Romney plan sort of talks about the candy, which is lowering the rates. He is indeed vague about how you're going to pay for all this. And in that, he's joined by every single presidential candidate of both parties who's ever run. They don't want to say the obvious things, though he has talked about it in generalities, that basically you've got to cut deductions or cap some of them. So the rich people do not get the mortgage interest deduction, maybe the charitable deduction. You got to hit the rich and cap their deductions.
All I know is that when Obama proposed to cap deductions, some of those deductions for the rich, every Republican in the country attacked him. So yeah. Good luck for that.
But Romney
that,
has. But
it was
Romney
well, I want to bring you guys idea. Back because trust me, this conversation is not going away. Tax policy is not an easy one. This past week, we had what could be the final debate. Essentially, Rick Santorum was in the hot seat. For instance, we have a clip of him here on the subject of earmarks, which he supported when he was in the Senate, or some of which he supported in the Senate.
I do believe there was abuse, and I said we should stop it. And as president, I would impose earmarks.
Well, I didn't follow all of that, but I can tell you this. I would put a ban on earmarks. I think it opens the door to excessive spending on projects that don't need to be done. I think there are a lot of projects that have been voted for. You voted for the bridge to nowhere.
The big insult, the bridge to nowhere. And it still gets a lot of mileage out of that. Gentlemen, what happened with this debate?
They're both being ridiculous. Some earmarks are perfectly legitimate, and that's the way you get legislation passed. And if you can't have earmarks, it's going to be tough to pass a lot of things. And this was my basic problem with the debate and with Santorum's position. Santorum was a politician. When you're a politician, as he says, it's a team sport. Sometimes you have to vote for things you don't like because your party needs you. You have to support people you don't like because your party needs you. You make compromises, and he made compromises, and he's being attacked for it. I suppose it's normal, but we should expect that our people who play the game of politics are going to behave sometimes like team players, and we shouldn't castigate them for actually playing the political game. It's the craft.
It was such a narrowly tactical debate. The notion that at this moment in our history, they spent all that time talking about earmarks. It was a dumb conversation, except when Newt Gingrich said, you can't say mine are good and his are bad, he was addressing Romney. But I thought it was a very disappointing night for Santorum, partly because of the 1-2 punch of Mitt Romney and his new ally, Ron Paul. Santorum had to spend the whole night on the defensive.
Right. At one point, Ron Paul looking at him and just calling him a fake to his face.
Exactly. And it was I actually felt for Santorum during that. At least his answer on earmarks, it was long and it sounded like I was for earmarks before I was against him. But it was actually a pretty honest answer. But he had a terrible night. And I think it bodes ill for him next Tuesday.
One other thing that came up in the debate I want to get to in just our short time here, the auto bailouts. We are rehashing this like crazy. And I want to get your opinion on that. Is it because this is an issue where you can actually score it in some way, its success or not? Sort of, why is this still so contentious?
Well, it's a policy that is now popular. 57% think it's a good idea. I was against it at the time. I now think it was probably a good idea. The oddity, though, is Mitt Romney wrote a very good op-ed for the New York Times, which was a lot of what Obama ended up doing. But now, to please the primary electorate, he's pretending he was completely against it. And so it's an idea, another example of him hiding his virtues in order to please an electorate which is more polarized than he is.
EJ?
Except that, as an op-ed by Steve Rattner, who was one of the architects of bailout, pointed out today in the New York Times, Romney was against the one thing that made it work, which was the government money. The auto industry couldn't raise any money at that time to keep going, so the industry would have gone out of business. And this is a rare case where a president can make a genuinely unpopular decision, and this was really unpopular, and look back and say, hey, guess what? I was right about this. This thing worked pretty much the way I said it would, maybe even better than I said it would. And I think it shows I supported the bailout at the time because there are moments when capitalism can't make it on its own. And we would have been much worse off if all of those companies connected to the auto industry plus GM and Chrysler gone out of business.
And it's clear, obviously, the focus was on Michigan voters. We'll be back to talk with you guys about that next week. EJ Dionne of The Washington Post and David Brooks of The New York Times. Thanks so much to you both.
Great to be with you.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Students look alert and engaged in Sandra Castillo's third grade class at the Primitivo Garcia Elementary School in Kansas City, Missouri. But the entire public school system in Kansas City has flunked. The State Board of Education revoked its accreditation on January 1st. The Kansas City Public Schools met just 3 of the 14 standards set by the Missouri Board of Education for basic proficiency. They got failing grades for attendance, graduation rates, math, and reading and writing scores. Last week, we reported on the decades of mismanagement, declining enrollment, and revolving door superintendents. Now, there's a struggle for the future of the schools that may be a battle for Kansas City itself. Sly James, the new mayor, says,
I can't think of anything that I'm supposed to do as the mayor of this city that is in some way affected by or built on education. Nothing.
From lowering crime to creating jobs and making the city grow.
I can tell you that the perception of having things that are not functional does not help you attract people and keep them in the city. They go to where they can find success for their children.
Mayor James, the Sly is for Sylvester, is a large, solid man who speaks with short, blunt stabs of his hands. He says that he should take charge, as mayors have in New York, Chicago, Boston, and other cities. He believes that only a mayor can wrestle bureaucracies and rally private resources and public opinion to save schools.
It is a crisis, and it's one that we have to address if we're going to stay vital and if we're going to repopulate this city and stabilize our tax base and grow.
The mayor would abolish the elected school board and create a corporate structure headed by a CEO, chief educational officer, that he would choose. James is a lawyer and new to politics. A lot of people in Kansas City laud his determination, but question the results of mayoral control in other cities. Some also see another option for reform that's right next door. A bill introduced in the Missouri State Senate would disband the Kansas City Public School District and force adjacent districts to absorb the city's public schools. We met Dr. Jim Hinson, the superintendent of the neighboring Independence, Missouri School District at Van Horn High School. Now, Van Horn was part of the Kansas City Public School District for over 50 years. It's now run by the Independence School District because 5 years ago, People in Kansas City and Independents voted to turn over Van Horn and six other Kansas City public schools to the Independence District. Test scores and graduation rates improved. 70% of the students at Van Horn come from families below the poverty line. The school offers counseling, meals, even dental service. Dr. Hinson says he saw Kansas City lose accreditation this year and asked,
if I have students that literally live across the street that are not in our school district, but I know historically the lack of success, do we have an obligation to try to be a part of a solution? And the answer for us is yes.
But critics say the apparent success Independence has had with a few schools shouldn't be a plan for all of Kansas City.
We're not saying everything is roses in the district. I don't think that parceling our schools out to suburban districts is a way to solve the problem.
Crystal Williams is a county legislator and a parent with a son in the Kansas City Public Schools. She's a small woman with short brown hair and a direct, challenging manner who describes herself as part of a crew of concerned parents who log long hours in community and committee meetings. They call themselves the Do-Gooder Mafia. She believes Kansas City should be left to work out its own solution to its school crisis.
The city is ready and willing to go forward and come up with the solutions we need.
But cities had 20 years. Why should anybody give them even another 20 months?
Because we have more engagement in this community than we've had since we've lived here. I think maybe there's more engagement than there's ever been. Sometimes when you're threatened with loss, you finally get your crap together and you move forward and do what you need to do.
But the number of families with children in the public schools has dramatically declined. Enrollment reached 77,000 in the late 1960s. It's just under 16,000 today. Stephen Green became Kansas City's interim school superintendent suddenly this summer after the previous superintendent unexpectedly resigned. Dr. Green has thick glasses, a trim beard, and speaks in calm, unhurried sentences. We asked him if the numbers in Kansas City have dwindled so seriously because most Kansas City parents just don't feel that their schools are good enough or safe enough for their children.
Yep, and I think they have good reason. I think we have not performed well. It's our responsibility to reverse that trend, to change that, particularly to change it in 180 degree is going to be an uphill climb.
When you say things like, we've got to change it 180 degrees, and it's a slow process.
Over time.
To a parent, that's not a good argument for them to entrust their children to you right now.
Well, I'd love to be able to say that I could snap my fingers and make it happen right away. But that's the reality. And I'm saying 3 to 5 years of turnaround is going to take.
Any turnaround will have to meet modern educational metrics, the hard numbers that translate to achievement. Dr. Green laid out the math problem that he has to solve.
If 5 or 6 students per grade level per building were to make movement from below basic to basic or basic to proficient, we will meet these academic achievement targets.
Dr. Green says the district has already met 2 more of the 14 standards to win back accreditation. So far, none of those standards has been academic, and there are 9 more measures. And schools have responsibilities these days that may not be tied to accreditation, but are vital. Like this. By their own numbers, roughly 9% of Kansas City public school students are homeless.
I need to give you one coat, but you have coats.
This is like the 3rd allotment of coats that they've gotten.
So this year, the district opened a shop in which parents who can't afford them can pick up school supplies and uniforms for their children, even socks and underwear.
I don't know, how many people do you think we served that day?
1,500
people.
That's where we found Fred Hudgens, who's had 3 children in the public schools. He's a heavy, smiling man who wears a union coat and hat. He's a crane operator, but between jobs now, and volunteers his time at the shop. He believes that Kansas City's failing grade could be a kind of wrecking ball to help the schools build something better.
You have civic leaders, you have politicians. The mayor even came in and gave a plan, which has never happened that I'm aware of over 40 years. And I think we start to look at how do we fix our city, because truly, this is a citywide problem. It's not just in the school district. You know, I think that this thing is going to come off. It's got to come off, or, I mean, you know, there's no other option right now.
Kansas City Public Schools have 2 years to try to gain back the state's accreditation. That's time they may not get. The bill working through the state Senate would dissolve the school district this summer, so the schools operate in uncertainty each day, which poses a question for any parent who sends a child into those classrooms. Do you want your child to stay in the Kansas City Public Schools while the adults work out their problems?
Social media and smartphones have transformed how Americans meet and mate. Technology is also changing how couples split up. When people have affairs or misbehave, they leave not just a paper trail, but an electronic one that's just as incriminating. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports on a new survey of divorce lawyers, and it reveals a big rise in the use of text messages as evidence in court.
Americans carefully craft our public image on Facebook. We edit emails, spell checking, rewriting. But text messages? Ken Altshuler, head of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, says we don't give those much thought.
So what happens is a lot of people will draft a text at the spur of the moment, feeling hot and bothered about something, and off goes the text message, but it's the same kind of written documentation that lawyers just love to go to town on.
More than 80% of divorce lawyers report an increased use of text messages in court. And Altshuler says once your words are in print, they're hard to disown.
I had one husband, frankly, who said in a text message, "I'm so angry at you right now, I could kill you." And he got charged with criminal threatening.
Just as with things we say, these little missives can be taken out of context, but they can also reveal a stark truth. Altshuler says they're key to cross-examination, a way to undermine someone's credibility. Take this text to a secret lover.
"We had a great time in Boston. I can't wait to see you again." And of course, you know, the person in that case said he was on a business trip in Denver.
In one custody battle, Altshuler says a text message single-handedly won the case. The mother claimed the father's drinking problem compromised his parenting. But the father was an excellent witness. He said he hadn't drunk in a year, and even his substance abuse counselor vouched for him. Classic he said, she said. Until Altshuler's client displayed a recent text from her husband asking her to pick up beer on the way home.
He sat there and stared at the text message for about 2.5 minutes. He had no answer. Case is over.
Some people have text messages that go back years. It depends on the size of the phone.
Stephen Ward is a private investigator with Pinkerton. He says as technology improves, so does the potential for texts as evidence.
If you actually look at the cell phones now, the size of the phone's memory is what most standard desktops were about 2 to 3 years ago.
A treasure trove of information, Ward says. But getting texts into court as evidence can be tricky, especially if it's a spouse's text you're after. If you've stolen a password to access them, they can be ruled inadmissible. And if they're on a company phone, watch out, says Ward.
You could be looking at things that are trade secrets that you're not entitled to see, that's actually corporate property, it's not yours, and you've done something completely illegal.
Ward says it's always best to let a lawyer subpoena a spouse's texts. But even using messages from your own phone isn't always a sure thing. Lee Knott tried to submit texts from her ex-husband during a custody battle. She used an app to send them to her email account.
And so each text message, even if it was only 4 words long, ended up taking a page. So that's hundreds of pages.
Knott says she got the sense the judge in a rural part of Washington state was overwhelmed and wary.
The judge said that he didn't understand the technology and that he could not be certain that it wasn't able to be tampered with.
In fact, some states only accept electronic evidence if it's been gathered by a professional. Lawyers love getting their hands on these smoking gun texts, but for their own clients, they have one overriding piece of advice. Don't write anything you don't want a judge to read. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ira Flatow, here with Flora Lichtman joining us now. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
with our video pick of the week. And it's really something different this time, special from out, coming from out over the transom, as we say in the publishing business.
Absolutely. Over the transom, one of our listeners, Edward Ates, submitted this video to us. He's a professional photographer and videographer. And he said that he was playing around in his studio during the winter. He does time lapse usually, and he's outside. But wintertime, he wanted to have something else to explore. So he looked into ice. And this is ice like I had never seen it before. You know, we'd done a piece on ice a few weeks
ago. Ice sculpture.
I felt like I understood it. No.
Right.
No. There is a secret side of ice.
Love it.
That is revealed in this video. It really is so beautiful. So here's what he did. He took cross polarizers and a macro lens. And so that's cross polarized light.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's like when you put sunglasses on. Those polarizing lenses.
Yeah, and I think there's two.
Two of them.
Right.
Yeah.
And what he found was this unbelievably colorful, intricate landscape of ice changing over time. So he time-lapsed a very zoomed-in look at ice, and it's really like abstract art. I mean, he said he was kind of blown away when he saw it. It's really worth a look.
So you actually watch the ice crystals developing in many, many colors over time.
Yeah.
In his time-lapse photography.
Yeah, so he used an intervalometer.
A who?
that's what I said. So it takes a picture every 1 second or 10 seconds.
Right.
And then he put them together and made this 2-minute video. And he said that I think after he had weeded out some shots, he was at 3,600 photos, I think. And that's what it made. But it really... just seeing these tiny little structures melt and reform and the colors change over time. And you know what? This is something that, you know, I knew all our listeners are just have troves of great video. I know you're out there with your video. I'm going to do the unthinkable. Please email me. My email address is, I can't believe I'm doing this, flora@sciencefriday.com. But if you're a scientist who loves video, or maybe you're a videographer who loves science, send it my way. This was really a neat find.
Yeah, this is a gorgeous video. It reminded me actually of the movie Fantasia, which I'm sure there was a fairy skating on the ice and all these crystals were forming, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
And it looks just like that. Beautiful formation, but in full color of these crystals growing.
It's psychedelic, really. I mean, it really is. And I asked if Edward had found any trends, you know, why certain colors appeared or what forms appeared when. And he said that it seemed like the bubbles made a difference. And that can be, as we know from our video a few weeks ago, how ice forms. So if you freeze ice slowly, you're going to have fewer bubbles, and that might change the structures that you get to see through these cross polarizers.
All right. So if you have videos, if you're a scientist or you make some great, cool videos, time lapse, send it to Flora. Send Flora an email, flora@sciencefriday.com. We really, and in all seriousness, we do want your videos, and we'll take very good care of them and distribute them for everybody to see. We'll add value to them, as they say in their business.
This one was very valuable on its own. Thank you, Edward Ates, for sending it in.
It's got music and beautiful. It's our video pick of the week up on our website at sciencefriday.com. And if you go to our website, you can also join our Science Friday growing community. And if you want to take it with you, it's going to be available in our iTunes and our Android apps. So
And our podcast.
Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Sarah.
That's about all the time we have for today. Our program senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intagliata and Namisha Serene Anand. Louis Quevedo is our Spanish language producer. He says Luis. I think I'm going to call him Louis. Sam Plato is our production assistant. Neil Rauch is our technical director at the controls here in New York. And as I say, if you missed any part of this program, go over to iTunes as a subscribe to our podcast, audio and video. And we're tweeting all week at SciFry, and you can also send Flora your videos. Good, nice videos, flora@sciencefriday.com. Also, we have an upgraded iPhone app, good for your iPad also, with Flora's videos, which are specially made to look gorgeous on your iPad. So download those as an app. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Almost any scandal in the world these days is described as a something gate. The phrase dates back to the summer of 1972, when five men were arrested in the middle of the night during a break-in at Democratic Party headquarters in the Watergate office building in Washington, D.C. The subsequent scandal brought down Richard Nixon's administration, made him one of the most notorious men in American history. Anytime someone observes, what did they know and when did they know it? It's not the crime, it's the cover-up, follow the money, or third-rate burglary. It's a Watergate reference, whether they know it or not. The Watergate crime and scandal have been exhaustively documented, but now a great historical novelist has run it through his imagination. Thomas Mallon's new book is called Watergate, A Novel. Tom Mallon joins us in our studios. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
With so much on the record, what's left to be imagined by a novelist?
Mostly how it felt, I think. I thought if you were going to do this as a novel, you had to get inside the people who were there. And so I try to tell the story from essentially seven different points of view and see what it felt like. And I avoid most of the big events that people – they certainly occur.
Yeah.
But I don't tell the story the way you would tell it in nonfiction. I tell it more as a series of private dramas and try to get a certain intimacy in it.
As you will learn on tour, there are Watergate buffs.
Oh, yes.
Like there are Civil War buffs and jazz buffs who will catch you on the smallest bit of,
yes.
of misinformation or imagined information.
Mm-hmm.
How important was historical accuracy to you?
I refer in the acknowledgments of the book to the always sliding scale of historical fiction. And I think you really have to make these decisions book by book and almost scene by scene. I don't violate any of the big historical moments, dates. Richard Nixon still resigns at the end of this book. It's not what in the historical fiction biz we call alternate history, where, you know, the South wins the Civil War and things like that happen. But within those events, I think there's still plenty of room for a novelist to imagine what might have happened, not instead of the real events, but in addition to the real events, and how people might actually have felt about them in a way that's somewhat different from what they put onto the record.
Mm. Your novel reminds us, when the men were arrested and the scandal began, Richard Nixon was at the height of his powers.
Absolutely. He was cruising toward re-election. He had a very weak opponent in George McGovern. McGovern wasn't nominated yet, but things were certainly trending his way. Nixon had been to China. Mm-hmm. He had been to Russia doing arms negotiation. And so he was on his way toward what happened in November, which was an electoral win with 49 states. And the sheer unnecessariness of the Watergate break-in is something that must have tormented him and his allies in all of the years that followed.
Watergate scandal, we think we know something about vivid characters like Martha Mitchell and G. Gordon Liddy, but let me get you to talk about Rosemary Woods, a longtime secretary.
She'd been Richard Nixon's secretary from the time he was in the Senate in 1950, so she'd been with him nearly a quarter of a century by the time of the resignation. She never married. She did not give interviews. She was very private. Her loyalties to him were extraordinary. Mm-hmm. She is most famously associated with the erasure of 18 and a half minutes on one of the tapes that was subpoenaed.
The picture of her, a dignified woman making an undignified stretch, became well known.
And I think that that must have been tormenting to her. And I've talked to a couple of people who knew her, and they remark on her charm, her wit. She was a terrific dancer. I talked to somebody who used to escort her around town, and he said, don't finish the book without giving her a chance to dance. And I tried to imagine what it must have been to feel the personal isolation that she must have been, because she was a single person, essentially by herself, but to be at the red-hot center of this catastrophe that was dragging down somebody that she admired unquestionably.
Yeah. So how fascinating is Richard Nixon to a great novelist?
To me, endlessly. I've actually been trying to write an essay about him, an actual nonfiction essay. Now that this book is done, grappling with him and sort of the way he loomed in my life for really so many years. He was, I'd say, the central public figure in my life. I went to fourth grade in the fall of 1960 wearing a Nixon Lodge button. And he was the president who presided through my college years, which were very tumultuous, from Kent State and then all through things like the China trip. And I had enormously conflicted feelings about him, the way people do about Lyndon Johnson. Mm-hmm. And I remember the night he died in 1994. I was living in New York in those days, and the news came over the television that he had died in New York Hospital. And I remember I started sobbing. And I started sobbing not in the way you sob for somebody that you had simple uniform affection for, but sobbing for somebody that you had a lot of admiration for, as well as some horrified feelings about. And, you know, Nixon was always worried about letting people down, and he did let people down, and he let down all the people like my father who were his fervent supporters. But he was a complicated figure. Bill Clinton, in his eulogy, said that the time had passed to judge Richard Nixon on anything but the complete record of his life. And it's a wildly, wildly mixed record.
After spending so much time with him, on the whole, can you like him?
I want to weasel out of it and say you can't give a yes or no answer to it, but I would have to say that unless there was part of him that appealed to me, I couldn't have spent the time with him. And, you know, most of the tapes now, not most of them, but an awful lot of the famous ones, the crucial ones, you can listen to them on YouTube now. And the number of nights that I fell asleep with Richard Nixon's being the last voice I heard, because I often write late at night, there must be some appeal other than morbid interest that kept me coming back to him.
Thomas Mallon, his new novel, Watergate. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When you think about the moon, once you get past thinking about Apollo, the moonlit romance, maybe cheese, your next thought is, so what? It's a big rock, a gray, dead place. But new research hints that the moon may not be as dead geologically as we might think, that on the far side of the moon, there are signs of tectonic activity recent within the last 50 million years. This counts as recent in geological time. Joining me now to tell us all about it is Tom Waters, one of the authors of that report published this week in the journal Nature Geoscience. He's a senior scientist at the Center for Earth and Planetary Studies at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum in Washington. Well, welcome back to the program, Tom.
Hi, Ira. It's a pleasure to be back.
You're very welcome. Tell us what's the evidence of recent 50 million year old tectonic activity on the far side?
Well, it's an interesting story, and it starts not quite 2 years ago when I was on before and talked about the shrinking moon that we had located using very high resolution images obtained from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which has been in orbit around the moon since 2009, we saw these features, these landforms that indicate that the lunar crust was actually shrinking. It was being contracted and forming these fault scarps. Mm-hmm. So we went looking for more of these now that we are continuing to get more and more coverage of the moon with these very high resolution images. And we found something we weren't expecting. We found just the opposite of the type of landforms that indicate contraction. We found landforms that indicate that the moon is actually expanding and being stretched and pulling apart, not by much, but a little bit. And these features actually are very narrow, very relatively long troughs that are formed when the crust of the moon is being pulled apart and just breaks, and then a section of it drops down.
Well, and what would be pulling it apart?
Well, that's an excellent question, and it's one of the really interesting aspects of the research that we need to continue to do, because we're not exactly sure what is causing this stretching within these small areas. Because, again, here we've had this picture of now a contracting moon. We have evidence for these global contractional faults. And here now we have
stretch marks.
Yes,
stretch marks. You didn't want to say it, so I said it for you.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, you rack your brain thinking about creative ways of describing technical jargon. Stretch marks never occurred to me, but it's actually a very appropriate, very accurate way of describing these things. So we're trying to figure out what are the forces that are acting to pull the moon apart in places that are competing with these forces that are acting to shrink the moon. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of possibilities. One intriguing one is the possibility that these areas that are actually being picked up and kind of stretched because magma is trying to rise below the surface. It doesn't make it to the surface, but it's trying to rise below, this rise up, and again, as it does, it mm-hmm. sort of lifts it up and cracks it and stretches it. The trouble with that model is, though, that we don't see any evidence for really, really young volcanic material on the surface of the moon.
Yeah.
But, it's really interesting how young these features appear to be.
So do you think that there someday might be a volcano that we might discover, or one that actually spouts out and is easy to see from your orbiting stuff?
I would not say no, but I also wouldn't make any bets.
that's go hedging your bets.
Right.
But it should be. But if you're saying what you're saying, if I hear you correctly, and I'll put words in your mouth, is that if there is molten lava under the moon, it should spout out someplace.
Well, it's possible.
It's possible.
It all depends on the conditions. I mean, there are, again, other possibilities for how these stretch marks, as you described them, may have formed on the moon. And another possibility is that they are connected with the fact that the moon is actually contracting. And what happens, at least theoretically, is the moon is contracting. Blocks of the crust may actually be bent and flexed as part of that contractional process. But we still have a lot of work to understand this. Again, some of my colleagues are not particularly thrilled with the idea of young volcanism on the moon. But again, one of the things that's really fascinating about these features are their youth. I mean, we have looked at these contractional fault scarps, and we knew that they were younger than a billion years, and we knew that they were likely much younger than a billion years, maybe hundreds of millions of years old, maybe even tens of millions of years old, but we couldn't be sure. One thing that's really interesting about these very, very small, narrow graben features, as we call them, is that they won't survive long at all on the moon because they're just very shallow, and the moon is an active place in terms of micrometeorite bombardments, and soil gets picked up and deposited. And so very small, very shallow depth trenches will actually be filled in. And we know this from looking at boulder tracks, of all things, boulders that had rolled down. And there's a great paper that was done in the mid-70s where an analysis of boulders that had rolled off a hill near the Apollo 17 site created a track. One of them had a track, another one didn't have a track. And by dating the age of the boulders, we could actually date how long that boulder had been sitting there. We knew when it rolled down the hill, we could determine how quickly these trenches would fill in. So that's really exciting because it gave us another way to date these that we couldn't use to date these contractional fault scarps. So we know these trenches can't be any more than 50 million years old, but that is so recent in geologic terms, Ira, that these things could be not only just 50 million years old, they could be 10, they could be 1 million years old. They could have been active 40 years ago. And that's the other intriguing possibility is
the science fiction music coming up.
Well, we had the great Apollo seismic network that was on the moon, put up by the Apollo astronauts and operated for a number of years collecting data on seismic activity in the moon. And the moon was active seismically very deep, but there was also a small number of moonquakes that occurred within the crust of the moon. And it's not impossible that those moonquakes are connected to these very, very young tectonic features.
So they could be really young.
I mean, yes.
40 years ago.
Yes.
Wow. And men were on the moon when they were happening.
And could be.
does the moon have plates like tectonic plates like we have?
No, the moon is in the let's put it this way. The Earth is really unique among the terrestrial planets in that it has this mosaic of plates that shift and collide into one another or shift past one another. And again, most of the tectonic activity and volcanic activity on the Earth is concentrated at these plate boundaries. Mm-hmm. The moon is like a one-plate object. The moon, Mercury, other planets in the solar system appear to be one-plate objects. So when they contract globally, it's acting on a single plate.
Yeah. So the other question being, if the astronauts were on the moon, why did they not see any of these stretch marks on their side of the moon? And you haven't found it on the bright side, so to speak, that's facing us.
Well, there actually are some on the near side, but you're right. Some of the most exciting, actually the most exciting example that we found is on the far side. It's almost exactly on the opposite side of the moon that faces the Earth. And it may, again, be that they're just subtle forces that are acting within the moon that are creating just enough force to create these graben. It's also interesting because it tells us something about the stress state of the moon very recently, and that helps us figure out how the moon evolved and maybe even how the moon formed.
But you're not giving up. That doesn't bash the idea that the Earth was hit by another body and smashed the moon off as a piece.
No,
that's still
no.
the active. This doesn't do anything to that theory.
No, this actually picks up when all that is over and the moon has actually coalesced and formed, and it's the sort of the history of the moon from that point on that these kind of observations could be very helpful in determining, again, the moon's evolution.
You know what you're doing? You're making the moon more interesting, which is dangerous, I think. Because then people are going to want to go back and study this stuff. We never thought we'd have to wonder about it, right? You know?
Well, it's true. I mean, one thing I want to mention is just, and it's very exciting. Again, this is one of the exciting things about being a planetary scientist. Right now, we have imaged less than half of the moon with these very, very high-resolution images coming back from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. So we have, again, literally more than half the moon to image with these, again, very high-resolution images. And we're very excited about the idea of finding more tectonic features, more features, said more surprises. And that's really one of the exciting things about exploration.
Yeah, it is. And how long will it take to finish the job here, all those photos?
To do the job completely, we may need about 4 more years, an extended mission. It takes quite a while. Seth, we've been in orbit since 2009, and here we are 2012, and we're still collecting data. So quite a while, and we're hoping to have an extended mission that will allow us to do that.
You mean like the little Mars rovers keep going with your mission?
Yes, well, we're very fortunate. The Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter spacecraft is extremely healthy. We're in a very stable orbit. We could easily operate for 4 more years.
Do you have the budget for that?
Well, that's a question I can't answer.
As they say in Washington, that's above your pay grade.
Exactly. Right? You took the words right out of my mouth.
Well, you could always help. You know, you could point to the success and the Mars rovers and things just keep going and finish the rest of the moon.
Well, when you think about it, too, it's a great investment. We've got it's a relatively small amount of money compared to what it would cost to rebuild a spacecraft like the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter and put it in lunar orbit.
Well, you know, what's on your side is exploring the moon has already been thrown into the presidential race in a different context, but we might have some other ideas here.
Yes, it's possible. One of the interesting connections was the idea of whether a moon base would actually survive now based on these new findings. And I think I can safely tell you that the moon base would not be in great jeopardy unless you actually built it on a fault surface.
All right, Tom, that's quite fascinating. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Tom Waters, senior scientist at the Center for Earth and Planetary Studies at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum in Washington. This is Science Friday from NPR.